This is Phil Farron. And I am driving to Ruby Tuesdays, the restaurant. My buddy that I get together with on Thursday nights said it would be better for him if we met at 5:30. It is 5:05. And since I've got about a half an hour here, I thought, well, maybe instead of driving home, I will just drive to the restaurant and talk as I have done in times past. And that way, as I'm going home from the restaurant, I'll just go straight home as opposed to driving around. Because if I didn't go straight home, if I went straight home from the restaurant, did driving home from there, it would actually only be like 10 minutes. So that might be a little short. So anyways, it is episode 129, and I had mentioned last week that I was probably going to finish up on the book Blink that I started talking about last week. Go ahead and get finished up on that book because there was one or two other things that I wanted to talk about. However, there was a big occurrence this week, and in the process of, I thought I had said everything I wanted to say, but in the process of everything that came up this week, and in the process of reading through some of that stuff, and then in the process of seeing some other things that happened this week, I thought, well, okay, let's just say some of these things again and, you know, make some people mad. So, hopefully not. Obviously, this last Sunday was the big anniversary, 10 years. The first thing that sort of started triggering me thinking about this and thinking about talking it again was watching a Nova special where they were talking about getting the 9/11 memorial done for the 10th anniversary in New York of 9/11. First of all, it's a beautiful memorial. It really, the guy was inspired. I would say that God whispered to him. It's a beautiful concept for a memorial. The thing is gorgeous. It's well executed. But what made me start to sort of tilt my head off to the side was when I was watching the Nova special on the memorial and on World Center 1, World Trade Center 1. It's the new building that's going up, which is a gorgeous building too. And they were talking to the people that were making the memorial, and they were going through the fact that when they drew up the original plans and then they started executing the plans, they realized that they weren't going to have the memorial done until 2013 or something like that, or 2012, 2013, I think it was. And they all talked and they all decided, oh, that can't be. Absolutely, that cannot be. It can, 'cause we have to be ready by the 10-year anniversary. Just have to. You just have to be ready. By the way, I'm not actually, you know, going my normal way. I'm just driving around some little streets. So that's why the car is going to sound like it's going slower than it normally does. If you've been paying attention. So, no way. It can't, you know, we absolutely cannot have it come in. We have to be ready on the 10th anniversary, because that's just, we have to. And I was thinking, okay, why? But apparently somebody decided somewhere. So in order to be ready for the 10th anniversary, what they did was they, instead of having the memorial sort of at ground level and have the fountains going down into the ground, they built it all up on a big platform and put a bunch of stuff underneath it. Okay, fine. And it's a beautiful memorial. And by doing this, it actually added hundreds of millions of dollars, if I remember the Nova program correctly. It added hundreds of millions of dollars to the project, but it shaved off 2 years and meant that they would be able, hopefully, to get it done by the deadline. So, okay. okay, that's fine. All right. Okay. So all through the program, they've got these guys sitting there and goes, because there's no choice. We have to have it done because the people just won't stand for it if it's not done by the 10-year anniversary. And I'm thinking, what is this? Why will, what? And I don't know if it was just for dramatic. Well, as it turns out, it was done for the 10-year anniversary. Ta-da! Everybody did a great job. It's a beautiful memorial. Okay, fine. Great. It's fine. You know, they had raised the money for it. They had the money for it. Ta-da! Okay, great. I got no problems with any of that. Beautiful memorial. I was watching the actual memorial service for 9/11 on Sunday morning and recorded it and kind of zipped through the rest of it. And some of it was about the time that I was starting to tilt my head off to the side, because it has been 10 years. It's been 10 years. And there were people that were standing up and were saying, you know, it just seems like yesterday when he was murdered. I mean, apparently some of the survivor families are very careful to say, no, he wasn't killed. No, he didn't die. He was murdered. I keep saying he was murdered. Okay, well, yes, that's true. But the term also, of course, carries heavy connotation of there is someone to blame for this happening, and we need to go find out who that is and bring them to justice. You know, that ladens the whole conversation with a lot of connotation. That's their choice. But you've got people standing up and saying, it's been 10 years, and it's just like yesterday, and we miss them so much. And I was just listening, and I was thinking, wow. Really, after 10 years, it's still this raw to you. You know, you haven't moved through this yet. 10 years, and you're not ready to let this go yet. So I was kind of thinking about all that. Thinking about this idea of murdered, you know, somebody needs to pay for this. And I came across this article where there's a book that has come out. Doesn't really matter what you think of the guy. His name is Ali Soufan, I think. And he wrote a book called The Black Banners. And then there's a subtitle. I don't know what it is. Anyways, it's about his involvement as an FBI investigator. It's really, really fascinating stuff. I mean, all we can do is simply take what he says and we can decide whether we want to believe him or not. But I find nothing in what he says that does not sound like something that, yes, absolutely could have happened. And in fact, the 9/11 Commission report backed up some of what he said. That he was involved with what was a breakdown in communication. Now, he wasn't the one where the information broke down, but he was on the front lines of it. And so this is his testimony about what happened. He, I guess, originally never wanted to be a part of the FBI. Someone dared him to apply. He applies. He gets a job at the FBI. One of the first papers he writes at the FBI is some research that he has done on Osama bin Laden. And he flags him and says, this is a guy that we need to be paying attention to. Okay. Mr. Soufan is Arabic. He speaks fluent Arabic, grew up in Lebanon. You know, obviously an intelligent man. Says, we got to be watching this Osama bin Laden guy. Okay, fine. So things are going along. Now, it's 2000. It's the year 2000, and it is in October of 2000. He gets a call as he's heading into work and says, you need to get into the office now. He says, I'm on my way. I'm coming. Because the coal the ship, the Cole. I don't know if you remember, there was a suicide bomber attack on the Cole. It had just been bombed, and they needed somebody to go over to investigate. And he was the obvious choice because the agency did not have that many people who spoke Arabic fluently. And they had even less who spoke Arabic fluently who were also monitoring Al-Qaeda. And Mr. Soufan was both of these. And so they sent him over and he began to interview suspects. One in particular that had been arrested, name of Kuso, I think. And he interrogated this guy and actually got inside the guy's head and was able to start extracting information from this guy. And I'm glancing at my notes as I'm driving, so hopefully I will get this all correctly. Kuso actually told him about being in Bangkok earlier that year. And so, you know, he was trying to get at him, well, why were you in Bangkok? Well, I was meeting with some people. And he knew that he had gone to Bangkok to meet with somebody with $36,000, that he had delivered this $36,000. And so Mr. Soufan dutifully passed that along to the CIA, asked them if they had any information about this, and was able to get the name of another man, I think he was Collard, that Kuso met up with Collard in Bangkok and gave him this $36,000. So he was trying to decide, okay, what's going on, and pass the information on to the CIA, requested information from the CIA, didn't get anything from the CIA back. Nothing. Just ran into what they called the wall. Some at the CIA, I guess, have said, well, you know, there was a Justice Department thing that might have been prevented us from sharing information, but they actually talked to the CIA counsel at the time, and he said, no, there would have been nothing, you know, to prevent us from sharing the information. Basically, what it comes down to is the CIA just didn't ever give him any information back. And he kept trying to, you know, he actually got this Mr. Soufan actually got a phone number in Malaysia from one of these interrogations of the suspects, and he forwarded that on to the CIA and said, you know, do you have anything on this phone number? Nothing he gets back from the CIA. His last request for information supposedly was in July of 2001. So now you're 60 days out. He watched 9/11 from Yemen. And, you know, he said had a sick feeling in the pit of his stomach. And he had gone to the airport and he was like ready to get on a plane when a CIA agent walked up to him and handed him a folder and said, here, we need you to look at this stuff. And so I guess, if I remember right, he didn't get on the plane. He went back to wherever he was working at and they started going through that, and he pulls out surveillance photos of this. In essence, what happens is he pulls out these surveillance photos and discovers that the CIA has had surveillance photos of the guy that Kuso went to meet with in Bangkok. So the guy Kuso went to meet with in Bangkok, they have surveillance photos of him with two other guys. In fact, this collared guy who was given the $36,000 turned around and then gave it to these two guys who happened to be two of the 9/11 bombers. They subsequently flew to Los Angeles. So here you have Ali Soufan, who's an FBI agent who is in Yemen, who has a lead on the guy who took the money to the guy who gave it to two of the 9/11 bombers. And in the interview I was watching of him, the interviewer asked him and said, if those leads had been connected, if you had gotten this information from the CIA, and this is what is acknowledged in the 9/11 report, that if the information had come from the CIA as it was requested, the man that Sufan was interrogating would have been connected to the guy in Bangkok, which would have been connected to the two 9/11 bombers. There probably would have been surveillance put on them. And Mr. Sufan says, you know, at the very least, the airports would have been alerted to these guys. They probably would have been detained at LAX. Well, he doesn't say probably. He just says the world would be a different place, period. The world would be a different place. But he said it's likely that many things could have happened and possibly the entire 9/11 plot could have unraveled at that point, because potentially they would have two of the hijackers in custody, and potentially they could have been interrogated. Now, that's just one of the things that's in his book, but it's pertinent to 9/11. There are other things in his book that we could talk about as well, concerning these enhanced interrogation techniques, that it is Mr. Sufan's opinion that the enhanced interrogation techniques didn't really give us what we needed. And he gives us he gives examples of that in the book. But, you know, I'm running out of time, so won't talk about that. If you want to look it up on the internet, you'll find there's a fascinating story about Ali Sufan actually talking to one of these guys, interrogating one of these guys, getting on his good side, starting to get information from him, and then they bring in a CIA operative that he codenamed Boris, and Boris comes in and starts doing the enhanced interrogation techniques on the guy, and the guy just, you know, clams up. And then after he's been waterboarded so many times, he finally says, yes, Al-Qaeda, you know, is working with Saddam, and Saddam has weapons of mass destructions. And it was that intelligence that then gets handed off to Colin Powell, and Colin Powell makes the big speech in the UN. And that's one of the major part of our motivation to go to war with Iraq. Because, you know, if Al-Qaeda is training there, that's a threat to our nation, and we can't let this happen again, and we've got to go over, and we've got to, you know, attack somebody, we've got to bring them to justice, because all our people were murdered. You know, instead of us looking at it and figure out how in the world did they get in this far and nobody saw it coming, instead of us saying we had huge breakdowns in communication. And just to finish up with the guy who said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction and Al-Qaeda was there, they went back to the guy after we had invaded Iraq, you know, and taken over this country. And they said, we didn't find any weapons of mass destruction. We don't have any evidence that Saddam ever worked with Al-Qaeda. And the guy said, well, I told you what you wanted to hear so that you'd stop torturing me. Ta-da. Anyways, because our response at 9/11, and there was actually an editorial piece that I've got like 14 pages of notes today. There's an editorial piece that a guy had written about why he had come out for war. You know, I think it was New York Times. I'm looking for it. And why he had supported war when he had been... Bill Keller was his name. Just came out with a really interesting op-ed piece for the Times, where he talked about his own personal progress, where he'd never been a war hawk. And yet after 9/11, you know, the drums started beating, he said we had this imaginary association of pundits call it, I can't believe I'm a hawk club. Of all these people who had traditionally not been for military action, now all of a sudden they're beating the drums. Why? Because we have to make somebody pay for this. We have to make somebody pay. And it really has the feeling, when you look at it from a flesh-spirit perspective, of a government that's feeling guilty about the fact that they dropped the ball so badly, and so they're just trying to find some enemy they can blame so no one will notice that it was really the government's fault that this happened. And there's all kinds of excuses, but the fact is the 9/11 Commission concluded that there were lots of places where this could have unraveled, and we just missed them. So instead of us taking responsibility for missing them, all the war drums get beaten. Boom, 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 boom. We've got to go to war. And we end up going to war in a country that has been the graveyard for conquerors for thousands of years, Afghanistan. We end up going to war in an area of the world where there has been tribalism for thousands of years. And end up bombing people and killing innocents, and certainly killing a lot of the quote-unquote enemy. But when you're dropping that many bombs and shooting that many bullets, you're going to kill Iraqis. And at this point, I was looking at some of the numbers. Just the war proper was something like $1.6 trillion is what it's cost. And when you factor all the other costs, it's like $3.3 trillion is what this has cost the United States, because we were quick to beat the war drums as opposed to say, could we have prevented this? And do we really need to live in a huge state of fear, or do we just need to get more careful and ask our citizens for help and see if we can't stop this at our shores, as opposed to going over and trying to take over two different countries? And in the midst, you know, of all this, in the midst of all this, I see a story that really made me feel bad for the people in the story. Because it's been 10 years. And if instead of us going over and invading two countries and getting into the morass that is Iraq and Afghanistan, if instead of doing that, we had redoubled our efforts to build schools with the help of the local populace, to build hospitals, to be humanitarian in our efforts towards the Arabic nations. You know, to step back and say, yeah, you know what? We have supported some petty despots over there, and we're going to stop doing that. Who knows? We might have been on the helping side of all these Arab springs that are springing up in all these countries. Who knows? Who knows? I don't know. I do know that when we have people who 10 years later are still mourning the loss of their loved ones, that that's a sad thing. And it's an especially sad thing when you hear the news report that I heard last night or the night before last, when they were talking about the memorial and the building of the memorial. And my buddy is going to be here in a minute, so I've got to hurry this up. For those of you who haven't seen the memorial, there's two big sunken fountains, gorgeous, gorgeous waterfalls, that kind of stuff. And around the outside of them, there are these large brass plaques engraved with the names of the people who died. In excess of 3,000 people. Okay, that's a tragedy. We don't really need to mention that the estimates are that 100,000 Iraqi civilians have been killed in the 10-year war. Never mind, or as how long ever we've been over there. 100,000 Iraqis have died in that war. So we have our 3,000, and the names are all engraved. Well, apparently there was one name out of 3,000, out of hundreds of millions of dollars of development, there was one name, at least that made the news, that was spelled wrong. First name was Jeffrey, as opposed to J-E-F-F. R-E-Y, it was spelled J-E-F-F-E-R-Y. And they had the individual's sister on. And after 10 years, this person's response was, you know, we were going there expecting everything to be perfect because this is what we deserved. We deserved to have it perfect. And then we went up there and saw his name and we saw that and it was just terrible. And so here we spent hundreds of millions of dollars to put together this gorgeous, gorgeous memorial. It's 10 years later. The 9/11 people that put together a memorial have apologized for it. They said they're going to fix it. But the reaction was, it was supposed to be perfect, and look what they did to us. Okay, something is wrong. Something is wrong there. And personally, what I think is wrong is that from the beginning, there was this huge flesh response of us not taking responsibility for what happened, not forgiving those who did it to us, not seeing what we could do to spread more kindness and love in the world. And instead, we've gone over and spent $3.3 trillion and taken over two countries, and now we're trying to figure out how we're going to get back out of it. This is Phil Ferrand, and I will be driving home later.